The Sophists and Socrates, Part 1. The sixth talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 7, 2012, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 3 in this series.
Okay, we've talked about the pre-Socratics ad nauseum. Now we are going to talk about Socrates. But in order to talk about Socrates, we first have to introduce the next group that comes along. Right on the heels of the pre-Socratics came about a class of people known as the Sophists. The Sophists are, they're kind of hard to define, but they're probably a combination or a cross between modern-day respectable academics and modern-day not-so-respectable attorneys. The populace probably in general had kind of a love-hate relationship with them. They were the butt of jokes, the focus of incredible rage by people who felt cheated by them, robbed by them, taken advantage of by them, on the one hand. On the other hand, they had a position that was sort of more or less respectable because they did two things. They gave public lectures, and that could prove to be entertainment for people, intellectual stimulation, the transmission of information by these sophists. The sophists would have different areas of research, knowledge, expertise, and they would lecture on those subjects. And then they also taught young people, so they were educators. They were the educators and the intellectual entertainers of Greek culture at this time. With the tiring out of the project of the pre-Socratics, which was metaphysical speculation, as that got to be a rather tired and pointless exercise, it ran its course, it wasn't getting anywhere, it wasn't coming to any real answers. As that got tired, the sophists began to change their perspective on what kinds of issues and what kinds of questions were actually important. So instead of focusing on the object, the cosmos, and what was the nature of reality and the nature of being and the kinds of things the pre-Socratics talked about, they began to turn toward man himself. How can we help man live? How can we equip a man to be successful? How can we equip a man to know how to get along in the city-state of Greek culture? And so they shifted from the cosmos onto human beings, and they also shifted from speculation to practical knowledge. What's useful and what's practical, that's what we need to transmit to the people that we're teaching. So as they would take on young people to train them for a fee, they charge money. So as they took on young people to train them, they were going to train them in skills and knowledge that was going to be directly and immediately useful for the most part. So all of them taught rhetoric. And rhetoric is the art of persuasion. How do you convince people of something? And the reason rhetoric was such a valuable tool in that culture is as the city-states experimented with different kinds of government, different structures, many of them democracies at times, it was a source of power to a person if they could speak to a large assembly and convince them of whatever it was that they wanted to convince them of. We need a new aqueduct. Let me tell you why we need a new aqueduct. I happen to have an aqueduct building. I happen to be an aqueduct contractor. But let me tell you why we need a new aqueduct. Well, there's economic advantage, social advantage, political advantage, if you can talk good. And by good, I mean persuasively, if you can persuade the assembly, the demos, the crowd. Or in other forms of government, anybody that you can persuade. If you can go to the people and control and empower and persuade them, then you gain power within that society. So everyone, or in the law court, someone sues you. If you don't argue very well and very persuasively, you lose the case. So you want to be able to win the case. So just as a matter of protection and insurance, you need to be instructed and skilled in rhetoric so that you can protect yourself in the law courts. So there are any number of ways that rhetoric was useful, so useful that everybody who came to be taught was first and foremost interested in learning rhetoric, and every sophist would teach rhetoric among the other things they taught. Because of their emphasis on that, their reputation was, and I think this is Protagoras, he's one of the better known sophists. I believe it was Protagoras, but I may not be remembering this correctly. He prided himself in being able to make white appear, with his words, being able to make white appear black and black appear white. Just appear unjust and unjust appear just. Do you begin to see the resemblance to attorneys? They were really kind of unscrupulous, unethical, without really any moral scruples in terms of how you would use the rhetorical skill that they delivered. And they even prided themselves in being able to make you that kind of unscrupulous manipulator of people. That's how skillful they were. They focused on the skill, not on the morality of what they were doing. What else do I need to tell you about the sophists? They also tended to be almost across the board cultural relativists. They had, in the interim, the horizons of Greek culture had begun to expand, and they began to get significant exposure to other cultures and other people groups. And as they got greater and greater exposure, they came to realize that there's different ways of thinking, different ways of viewing the world, different value systems, different legal systems. And so and that's been true throughout history, whenever a culture expands and its horizons are expanded by exposures to other cultures, one of the things that's always, you're always tempted to do is become a cultural relativist. Because you can always take the position that what's right and true here is right and true here. Obviously, what they think is right and true over there is right and true for them. How do we process that, or how do we interact with that? I guess we're all right. I guess we're both right. I'm right in my city-state, and you're right in your city-state. But there's no external perspective from which to judge the superiority of one set of values over another. And that was the tendency of the sophists. That's a major, major part of what Socrates reacts to in the sophists.
What I'm hearing you say is that for the sophists, there was no ultimate right or wrong.
Right.
Is that correct?
I'm generalizing. You might be able to find an individual sophist who would have some kind of concept of an ultimate right and wrong, but especially the best known sophist is Protagoras. He's the one that you maybe have heard his quip that man is the measure of all things. And what he meant by that is exactly that the individual person within the context of their culture, everything is measured against himself as his own standard. And I mean, he intended that to be a fairly explicit statement of cultural relativism.
Well, isn't some amount of cultural relativism true? For instance, take the way we dress. You have lots of cultures.
Yeah.
Dress all kinds of different ways. Posing on.
It's okay. I mean, there's nothing morally wrong with that.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to make a distinction between etiquette, custom, fashion, that kind of thing. That's different than moral values. What's interesting is when I was studying at the university, we had an introductory, I was a GTF in an introductory class on ethics, and we had an introductory textbook. The article on cultural relativism in the ethics book that we used in a philosophy class was by an anthropologist. And there's no, that's not an accident. In fact, most cultural relativists at the university are not philosophers. Philosophers realize that you're going to quickly get into trouble with cultural relativism. You can't make any sense out of it. It makes no sense. Philosophers know that. Social scientists don't. And so anthropologists, sociologists, psychologists, those are the fields that are very much proponents of some kind of cultural relativism. And it's precisely because the examples that were given in the by the anthropologists were basically examples of difference in custom. Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that different cultures have different customs. I mean, the least little exposure is going to tell you that. I mean, we have different customs within the same culture. And we recognize that people have different ways of doing certain things, different ways of dressing, different dialects, different ways of different syntax, that kind of stuff. Those kinds of differences are not moral differences. They're not differences of moral judgment. They're differences of a more practical nature.
So some kind of cultural relativism is true. Etiquette, maybe to some degree in politics, customs. If it works for you, it works for you. No big deal.
Right.
But the real issue with the sophists is what? Something like murder? Adultery? I mean,
yeah.
Is there any culture that really we can say that's relative? I mean, isn't that kind of universal among cultures that outright murder and adultery generally is frowned upon?
There are a few. I think the two that I have heard by anthropologists that are universal are incest and murder. But everything else is, you can find variations on that. Within certain aspects of history, there are a wider range of things that are pretty much shared values. But the reason they're shared values is because they're moral in nature. And the issue is there an objective moral universe, an objective moral truth? And out of that objective moral universe, you can judge different cultures and different values and different cultures. Socrates is going to insist, absolutely, of course. The sophists are starting from the platform of, no, you can't. And merely because customs were different, they just automatically jumped to, there's no objective moral truth.
It's interesting how much, I mean, the sophists really parallel the paradigms of today.
Mm-hmm.
That Very the nice. Same logical leap is made from custom differences all the way to morality being yeah. relative. That's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay. I'm sure I've forgotten some things, and maybe I'll have to come back and backfill. But you basically have the picture of the sophists and where they're coming from. Okay, so we get to Socrates. Socrates was a... Socrates didn't write anything. So that's one of... It's difficult to really know the historical Socrates, or at least some people argue that it's difficult to know the historical Socrates because he didn't write anything. We don't have any unfiltered information about him. We have three main sources. I think there's actually four. I can't remember the fourth, but three main sources. Plato's Dialogues. Plato was one of many students of Socrates. So that's our major source. Xenophon wrote some things on Socrates, probably fairly reliable information. I don't know that stuff very well, so I don't really have my own judgment on that. But people look to that. And then you have a play by Aristophanes where Socrates is the protagonist. And my judgment, my interpretation would be Socrates teaches us in Aristophanes, teaches us nothing about Socrates. In fact, I think Socrates in Aristophanes' play, The Clouds, is actually a placeholder for sophists in general. So the play is making a mockery of the sophists, but it names the protagonist sophist in the play, Socrates. But I don't think that gives us any helpful information about the real Socrates. So I'm going on Plato's dialogues. Those are the things I'm more familiar with. So all of my interpretation here is from there. The problem in Plato's dialogues is that Plato wrote them. And my contention would be, I remember the first time I read Plato's dialogue, you know, I knew that Socrates was supposed to be a big deal. I knew that Plato was supposed to be a big deal. You know, rumor had it, I had heard somewhere that that was true. So I was anxious to read one of Plato's dialogues. And I'm reading along, and Socrates is making absolute, and I'm like a sophomore in college or something like, is making absolutely ridiculous, absurd arguments. And I went, this is a great philosopher? I mean, dude, I'm a sophomore in college, and I can see the fallacy in that argument. What is going on here? And no one really helped me with that particularly. It wasn't until I was in graduate school and I read a ton of Plato's dialogues. And I began to get what's going on. It seems to me that Plato's dialogues are fiction. Fiction. He's created literature. And the characters in this literature are cartoon characters. They're really comical, extreme, odd. There's nothing very realistic about the characters in the dialogue. I mean, it's laughable. It's really kind of cute and clever. You get the rhythm of it, and you go, Socrates will say, now, if something is one, then it has to be beautiful, doesn't it? Oh, yes, Socrates, most certainly. Of course, yes, certainly. And then he'll go the next step. Oh, yes, Socrates, certainly. That's an excellent observation, of course. And he'll do that three or four or five or six times. None of the things he said was true. And we'll have to talk about that when we get to Plato, because there's more going on there than just the literature and just the cartoon nature of it. But you don't get good philosophy in Plato's dialogues directly. The arguments are not good philosophical arguments. But the meaning and purpose and the significance of the dialogues is incredibly insightful, I would argue. I mean, it's some of my favorite literature outside the Bible. I mean, and for moral education and for inspiration and that kind of thing. So, but if you're looking for the real live historical Socrates, you're not going to really find that portrayed in most of Plato's dialogues. Now, there are some exceptions. The Apology, perhaps. What is that? Credo. No, is that what I mean? There are some where it's a fairly realistic and poignant conversation between Socrates and his disciples. He's about to die in one of them, in a couple of them. He's about to die, and he's just talking about, they're just spending the time before his death. He had, as you probably know, I'm assuming you know the story, he ended up being convicted of atheism and corrupting the youth of Athens, and was given the choice between exile and drinking hemlock and poisoning himself to death. And he chooses drinking hemlock and poisoning himself to death over exile. And that's the topic of one of the dialogues, is why would you choose that? They're letting you, they don't want to have to execute you. Why are you choosing that? And the dialogue is all about why he chose the execution. Those dialogues are poignant and relatively realistic and wonderful, wonderful dialogues. And those give, I think, some real insight into the real man. But once you leave the two or three dialogues of that nature, you're dealing with Socrates, the cartoon character that Plato has created in order to convey some of Socrates' ideas. But not just Socrates' ideas, Plato also uses Socrates to convey Plato's ideas. So the issue is, what does Socrates believe and what does Plato believe? Can you find a seam in the dialogues between the philosophy, philosophical values and ideas of Socrates as opposed to philosophy and the philosophical ideas of Plato? Can you find that seam?
I'm going to show my historical ignorance here. How do we know Socrates was a real person that actually existed and had these ideas?
No one really questions that. Everybody talks about Socrates. Copleston, in his History of Philosophy, he makes the claim that every philosopher in the next couple of generations after Socrates claims to be a disciple of Socrates. And they all claim to be a disciple of Socrates, even though you have widely divergent viewpoints. This person over here is saying has a completely different philosophical system and set of values than this guy, and both of them are claiming they were disciples of Socrates. What that suggests to me, if that's true, and I see no reason to challenge that, what that suggests to me is he was a bombshell in the middle of history, an incredibly powerful and influential man that just influenced all the generations after him. So when you leave that kind of footprint, you must have been real to leave that kind of footprint. So the seam between them. When I was in graduate school reading them, I began to see what looked like a very definite, identifiable character to Socrates' perspective and his teaching, and other extraneous elements that looked like they didn't belong. And I began to, I thought, tell the difference between them. This was Socrates. This is what Plato was loading onto his Socrates character, but he was really conveying his own ideas. And it looked to me like you could tell the difference. I was flattered then later in reading Kierkegaard. There's a very important passage where he talks about the seam between Socrates and Plato. So he saw, I don't know if he drew the line the same place that I did, but at least he was pretty clear that there was a division there. And then I was reading a biography by Paul Johnson on Socrates, and he makes the same claim. So that gives me some confidence that I wasn't just completely dreaming that up and making that up, but other people think they can see the distinction as well. So I think it's really there.
Mm-hmm. Could you just give us some dates for Socrates?
Well, his trial was, somebody told me the other day, I think 399. That's when his trial was. Anybody who actually knows dates, is that? Well, Plato's the next generation. He was his student, so he comes right after that. Aristotle was Plato's student. So it goes Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, a generation apart, each the student of the other.
If Socrates was so important and had such an influence, why don't we have writings? I mean, have we lost them?
No.
He just didn't write?
Right. In fact, he has two or three passages where he talks about how worthless it is to write books or to give speeches. Jesus didn't write either. Yeah. I mean, when you stop to think of it, some of the most significant figures in history did not write books.
I wasn't sure that only Paul Johnson and Kierkegaard saw the seam. Would you talk more about that? So what is the mainstream perspective of them on Socrates, that he is basically just something that Plato made up in his dialogues? I mean, they obviously know that he existed, mm-hmm. but what is the other people that haven't seen
him? No, I think traditionally people assume that you can get some kind of sense of Socrates from the dialogues. The only thing that the place where I differed is I thought I was coming to a standpoint where I was pretty confident I could see the difference, whereas the more traditional view is, well, of course we can't really know. And I wasn't being quite that agnostic. You know, I thought, well, no, I think I can see the difference. And both Kierkegaard and Paul Johnson, I think, were hinting that they thought they could see the difference as well. So that's what was confirming for me.
Mainstream philosophy then sees the two kind of like blending in together,
yeah,
as opposed to being separate.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that when you talk about philosophy, you have to kind of talk about them together and not pretend like you can really separate them.
Yeah. Okay.
So in these cartoonish caricatures of Socrates, are they presented with a kind of historical pretense? Are they presented with a historical pretense that is like depicted as if they actually happened?
I don't think so. Not really. I mean, if you could kind of naively approach the dialogues and assume that, mm-hmm, but I don't think Plato's doing anything to try to deceive you in that regard. Well, with the juniors and seniors, we read one recently where it starts the dialogue. We had this conversation, and I took really good notes. Well, come on. I mean, it's obvious that there wasn't anybody that would have any reason to be taking really good notes, just a literary device to get him into the dialogue. And that's the kind of thing he does all the time.
And you think that Plato, as the author, expects his readers to sort those things out?
Yeah, yeah. What both Plato and Aristotle, according to Copleston, again, in his History of Philosophies, Plato had lecture notes, but he wrote dialogues. The dialogues were for popular consumption. The lecture notes were for teaching in the academy. What the academy was, the school that Plato started. In Plato's academy, he had lectures to his students, and he had lecture notes that go with that. Those have been lost, and nobody has we don't have any extant copies of his lecture notes, but we have most of his popular dialogues. Aristotle did the same thing. Aristotle had lecture notes for his students, and he also wrote popular dialogues. We don't have any of the popular dialogues for Aristotle. We only have his lecture notes. So it's really misleading for that reason, because Plato is really kind of fun to read. Aristotle is tedious as can be. But it's partly just a function of what it is we have to work with. Aristotle's are lecture notes. Of course they're tedious. If we had seen his dialogues, undoubtedly they would be just as lively and engaging and compelling as Plato's dialogues probably were.
Yeah, because that genre distinction seems important, because as you're laying out your discussion about the historical Socrates, it seems really reminiscent to me of liberal scholarship on the historical Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that, you know, we have these sets of documents and they contain something of the historical Jesus, but that there's also these embellishments in these fallacies and these cartoons.
That's a great point, because it would be really helpful to go take a really good sampling of Plato's dialogues as compared to the gospel accounts, for example. There's no comparison.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no missing the fact that this is fiction. I mean, it's just unmistakable. Whereas the gospel accounts really are presenting themselves as real, actual events and teachings and so on. They're not pretending anything other than this is true to history and true to fact. Anything else on that?
So who has these writings? Where are they? And were they like written on papyrus, or was there a scribe that took notes? You know, how did that actually happen?
Yeah, the lecture notes?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were compiled by Andronicus of Rhodes in... Don't even if I give you a number, never trust it. but a few generations later, Andronicus of Rhodes compiled it, and he took them from students' notes.
So they weren't Plato's notes.
No, you mean Aristotle's writings?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, they were students of Aristotle. Plato's school is called the Academy. Aristotle's school is called the Lyceum. They started a school. And you see those referred to throughout history. So if you want to memorize something, remembering the names of their schools is good, because whenever you're reading history and they talk about the academics, they mean the Platonists. it depends on who's writing and when. They either mean the Platonist and Platonic philosophy, because it comes out of the academy, his school. But eventually the academy stopped being Platonist, became skeptics and other schools of thought. And at that point, when they talk about the academics, they just mean the people who hung out at the academy and taught there. So
just one more question then. So where are they? And have you seen them? Have you seen the writings?
I'm sure they're...
In what museum are they?
To whatever extent they are extant now. Well, okay. I doubt if the notes themselves, any have survived, but they got compiled by Andronicus of Rhodes, and that became widely read and widely disseminated. So there are probably several copies of that around. I don't know how old the oldest manuscripts go back. I'm sure some museum somewhere has them, or if not, some classics professor has them in his library. Okay, now who was Socrates? This is my pet theory. No, you won't read this anywhere. This is just coming from me. I think Socrates was a prophet to the Greeks. Now, when I say that, I think the only prophets on the order of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, you have to be a Jew to be that kind of prophet. I mean, to play the role that they played in the history of Israel among God's own people, you don't have Gentile prophets in that sense. But I do think you have people who God has appointed, God has sent, God has set apart to go and have a kind of ministry, if you can call it that, a kind of ministry to certain Gentile people groups. I think you arguably there have been Americans who have been, in that sense, prophets to America. I know a huge influence in my life was Francis Schaeffer. And I think arguably Francis Schaeffer was sent to be a prophet to America at a certain point in time. Jonathan Edwards may have been a prophet to America at another point in time. George Whitfield might have been a prophet to America, where they had this huge impact on the very culture of America because of their proclaiming the truth, in their case from the Bible, but proclaiming the truth of the Bible into our culture. Well, Socrates predates Jesus. He's postdates most of the Hebrew prophets, and that would be a very interesting question to know if there was anything that Socrates was exposed to from the Hebrew prophets that might have in any way impacted him. That would be a very interesting question. I don't know of any evidence of any contact, but when we get to hear what Socrates has to say, boy, it sure sounds familiar in a lot of ways. So you can't help but wonder. But in any case, it would not surprise me at all if Socrates was set apart by God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to go and wake up and shake up Greek culture at a certain point in history. My reasons for that are twofold. One is the content, and we probably won't be able to get very far into that tonight, but we'll finish it next week. One is the content of what he was about and everything he had to say. But the other one is Socrates on two or three occasions talks about having a daimon. A daimon is where we get the word demon, but he doesn't mean demon. A daimon was just what was a daimon? It's difficult. A kind of a spirit, yeah, an invisible voice. I mean, it might have been what one of the prophets might have called a burden, you know. But in Socrates' case, he describes it as a voice that would warn him against certain paths or certain directions that he might otherwise be inclined to take. So it kind of he had a voice that steered him through his life. You just have to wonder. I mean, is that God operating in his life not completely unlike the way God would operate in the life of a Hebrew prophet? I don't know, but maybe. So the content of what he had to say, coupled with this strange relationship that he claims to have with the daimon, just has to make me wonder whether we're not dealing with some kind of prophetic role that he played. Socrates tells in his own story that he was just kind of minding his own business throughout life, or in his life. And by the way, he was in the military and a number of battles, and he distinguished himself as of being a very courageous warrior in the battles. So this is no wimp. He was a classical Greek in a lot of different respects. He was really ugly. He says so. Which I like to think all the most intelligent people in the world are the ugly. He was really ugly, but otherwise was a remarkable man, quite apart from this stuff that we're going to be talking about. But he was minding his own business when one of his friends went to the oracle at Delphi, and the oracle at Delphi was, supposedly a place where, what god was it? Apollo? Yeah, where Apollo sent messages to you, and there was a priestess, I believe. It was a big crack in the ground, and probably there was subterranean geothermal activity, and we know that makes noise. So the priestess would sit by the crack in the ground and hear these noises. And if you would come and inquire and ask a question of the oracle, they would wait for the noises and then they would interpret the noises to you, to what they said. Well, one of Socrates' friends went to the oracle at Delphi and asked, who's the wisest man in Athens? And the answer came back, Socrates. And so the friend comes and tells Socrates that the oracle said he was the wisest man in Athens. And Socrates says, wow, that is really weird that I would be the wisest man in Athens. So he had to think about why would the oracle say that he was the wisest man in Athens? And finally he decided, and I think it had something to do with an inscription over a temple that said, know thyself. And there was this inscription. And inspired by that inscription, he came to realize, I know why I'm the wisest man in Athens, because I know I'm not wise. And that, now see the backdrop of the sophists. You probably can't see it because I didn't explain it to you. The sophists were incredibly arrogant, incredibly self-promoting. You know, come to me and I can give you great success and make you a wonderful I can teach you rhetoric and you'll be powerful and eloquent and all this kind of stuff. And I will impart virtue to you and you will be a good Athenian citizen, blah, blah, blah. Very self-promoting. They definitely thought that they were wise and had wisdom that they could impart to others. Socrates, against that whole culture of sophistry, said, that's why I'm the wisest, because I know I'm not wise. And that's a theme, I think, throughout the dialogues, throughout Socrates' life, throughout his teaching, is just the intellectual humility that he thinks is foundational to wisdom. Sound familiar? Sounds like something out of the Proverbs. You know, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Socrates could say that. An accurate self-appraisal, how an accurate self-appraisal is so foundational to even beginning to have anything like wisdom. Socrates is saying that all the time in a lot of different ways from different directions.
So you must know that, you know, in some of your descriptions of Socrates and then like these American guys, that you're crossing some theological lines in the sand that people draw.
Like from pagan to Christian?
And I'm not objecting. I just want to recognize and see your response.
Well, interestingly, now I'm not a real fan of the institutional church throughout the ages. So I'm not proving anything by this because I don't respect it enough for this to even be evidence. But the early Roman Catholic Church canonized Socrates.
As a saint?
Yeah.
I'm convinced.
And it's no mystery to me why they would do that. I mean, when you read him, you have to know how to read the dialogues, because if you don't read the dialogues the way I think they need to be read, you can certainly form some significant misapprehensions about what Socrates, who he is, what is interesting to him, what he values, and so on. Because remember, he's a cartoon character. So in a number of dialogues that at this time in Athens, pederasty, that is sexual relations between an older man and a younger man, was pretty rampant in, I would argue, not necessarily in Greece and in Athens, but in the subculture that Plato is using as the backdrop for all these dialogues. So you have all kinds of discussion about being in love and somebody being beautiful and infatuation and all that kind of stuff. And the cartoon character Socrates enters the fray and is sometimes bantering along with them. And you might get the impression that he's really on the same page with all of them. But if you read the dialogues carefully, it's really interesting. Whenever it gets explicit, he rejects the practice. He rejects the desires, the lusts that are behind the practice. He really doesn't seem to be at all supportive of it. But if you just read a paragraph where he's kind of, oh, look what a beautiful boy he is and that kind of stuff, that you would get the impression that he's right on board with them. But he's not. Paul Johnson also says the same thing.
Because what this view of Socrates suggests is that in the biblical narrative, you have the story of God's saving and creating a redeemed people. But this view would suggest that outside of the biblical narrative, God is still working. Mm-hmm. Outside of the story God's telling in the Bible, he's working with Gentiles. He's working with people. He's calling out people for his name outside of anything that's even talked about.
Right.
In what we consider to be the canon or call the canon.
Yeah.
And I'm not opposing that. I just
want to recognize that. That's what I would argue. Yeah.
The other thing is...
go ahead. What I don't know is the chronology here, but I read a prayer by Chief Seattle once.
Who's that?
A chief of some... What tribe is it? Up in the Pacific Northwest. Seattle gets its name. Could be... But it's an incredible prayer. Now, maybe it was influenced by missionaries, Christian missionaries. I don't know, because I don't know what it's derived from. But the prayer is to the Great White Spirit, and is in the language of Native American religions, not in Christian language. But when you look at the content of it, it's pretty incredible. So. Chief Joseph seemed to be a pretty incredible man as well. So I think when you look at God has not left the peoples of the earth without a witness to him throughout time, and that's my assessment. The way to eternal life is always exceedingly narrow. So just because you have a prophet to a people group doesn't mean he had much impact. Socrates got himself dead. He just got killed. I mean, that sounds familiar too. The prophets are always getting themselves killed; they don't survive. But it doesn't mean that God's not trying to speak into their situation and call people to Himself. I think.
Also, calling people prophets after the apostles died, like the founding fathers, or I don't know who you meant, maybe the founding fathers. It's kind of taboo.
Well, don't get stuck on the term.
On the terms.
Yeah, if you want to resume.
I'm not against the term. I just want to know what you mean by that.
Well, obviously a prophet in a biblical sense is pretty unique. And that's what I was saying early on. You've got to be a Jew to be a prophet in the biblical sense. No Gentile could ever play exactly that kind of role. So I'm trying to redefine what I mean by prophet is just be the one that God sent to a certain people group to alert them, wake them up, call them, invite them, call them to repentance. I think whatever role you want to call that, that's what I'm talking about.
You think that's one of the biblical definitions
of prophet? Probably not. It's the reason I use the term prophet is because when you do look at Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and so on, look how much energy they spent reciting the history of Israel and calling people to account for in view of that history. Here's what God has done for you. Here's the grace he's shown you. Here's the promises he's made to you. Repent. Honor God. Respect God. Follow God. Believe God. So that particular thrust of what they were doing, that I think is transferable to other people in other cultures doing comparable, analogous kinds of things. Obviously, they're not reciting the history of Israel, but they are calling their attention to a transcendent God who, in whatever language they might use for that, that is the author of their being and is the ultimate hope of mankind, and they need to take that seriously and try to do business with that more.
Last thing is, how do we know he's the ugliest guy? Like,
he says so.
Oh my God!
Oh, he's constantly talking about how ugly he is, yeah. And he doesn't seem to mind. He's perfectly okay with it. Okay. Anything else? Any of you Gutenberg students? Can you think of anything to fill in that I have?
So he died in 399, and he was 71 years old.
71? Oh, really? Okay. Well. I want to get in. Well, let's hold off on his. Let's go to D on your notes, because I think that's all we're going to have. We aren't going to have time for much of this, and I want to spend a significant amount of time on his project. But we'll do that. We'll do that next week. But let's jump down to D, his criticism of the sophists. He rejected their narrow understanding of utility and practicality in favor of objective universal goodness. Actually, before I talk about his criticism of the sophists, the thing that's really notable about Socrates is that he is not at all interested in the kind of metaphysical speculation that we saw in abundance among the pre-Socratic philosophers. It's just not interesting to him. In that respect, he's in the same kind of culture as the sophist who had rejected that in favor of some practical knowledge. But Socrates is not going their direction. It's not practical knowledge. He's not interested in teaching you the skill of rhetoric and how to manipulate people and how to get your way in the world and how to be powerful and successful in Athens. Against the sophists, he's going to say, in effect, a message that comes through loud and clear is, what does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his soul? That if he could very easily have said exactly those words, and he says it over and over and over again in dialogue after dialogue after dialogue. So for him, the sophists are focused on gaining the world. Let me give you the tools. Let me give you the skills so that you can be successful, prosperous, powerful, famous, and so on. That's what it's all about. Socrates is not at all interested in that, because that's all part of this world that's passing away, that's temporal, that's ephemeral, that's insubstantial, that's really not all that important. What counts is what you're investing in your soul, because the soul is eternal. For those of you who are studying 1 John with me, that's right out of 1 John. Do not love the world or the things of the world, for anyone who loves the world, love of the Father is not in him. The world is passing away and in the desires that belong to it, but the one who does the will of God abides forever. That's exactly John's argument. Because there's a part of what makes me me that has the potential to go on forever and not be destroyed, that's what I need to invest in. That's what I need to be interested in. That's what I need to nurture. And Socrates' language for that is the soul, nurture the soul. Not really a biblical word particularly, but I think it's a comparable or at least an analogous kind of concept. That's an important theme for Socrates, in direct contradistinction to the Sophists. But both of them have turned and focused on human being and human existence, not the cosmos and speculation about the nature of reality and the nature of the cosmos. But once they turn toward human beings, then they take radically different paths. One says, how can a human being gain the world? Socrates says, never mind that. How can a human being gain his soul? I would consider, now the distinction I make is between, and these are just basically two different ways of doing philosophy. A philosopher can be a speculator engaged in metaphysical speculation, a picture builder, a system builder. I'm going to have every answer to every question answered in my system. You're going to see that a lot in philosophy. Or you can have what I would call an existentialist philosopher. Socrates is an existentialist philosopher. Now, I use that word in a particular way, and from now on, I'm going to use it this way. When you think existentialism, I don't mean the existentialism of Jean-Paul Sartre or Albert Camus or Nietzsche or Heidegger or any number of other philosophers that would be classed as existential philosophers. They have an atheistic, nihilistic worldview. They have no belief in God, no belief in anything transcendent. That doesn't even enter into their picture. They're classed as existentialist philosophers, however, not because they're atheists. And I think for most of us growing up in Christian culture, we've been taught that existentialism is the boogeyman. And the reason for that is because we equate the only existentialism we have in mind is atheistic, nihilistic existentialism. But the guy who invented the term is Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard was a Christian. Kierkegaard was a better Christian than we are, and who understood the faith probably better than we do. So what he meant by the term is, start with the word existence. By existence, he means human existence, not the existence of tables and the cosmos and atoms and stuff like that. He means human existence. And actually, what he means is a particular individual human existence. So you've got one of those. So what is the question, the most important question for you? It's the question of existence. And what he means by that is your existence, your individual particular existence. That's the most important question, and anything that revolves around that. Why am I here? How should I live? What does it mean to be me? Who am I? Those questions that all center in my own individual particular existence are existential questions. So an existentialist philosopher is a philosopher who focuses on that set of questions, because those are the questions we need answers to. All the other stuff is unimportant by comparison. Who am I? What kind of being am I? I was just talking off the top of my head. I couldn't reproduce them. How should I live? What should I do with my existence? How should I define my existence? Those kinds of questions.
Yeah.
Okay, do you understand the distinction between speculative philosophy and existentialist philosophy? Socrates is an existentialist. The Hebrew prophets were existentialists in that sense. Jesus was an existentialist in that sense. Paul and the apostles are existentialists in that sense.
So then what were the nihilistic, atheistic existentialists?
What
questions are they asking?
Same questions. That's why they're called existentialists, but very different answers.
Okay.
It's the answers that differ, but what they share in common and what that category existentialism or existentialist captures is the nature of the questions they're trying to answer. There's one other thing they have in common, and that is a certain set of assumptions, human freedom and how important human freedom is, the human individual, how important the human individual is. They assume, all of them, atheist or Christian alike, what they all assume if they're existentialist is, I am accountable for my own existence. And I'm responsible for the choices that I make that define me as a particular individual. I can't lay that off on anybody else. I'm the one that's responsible for it. Actually, the best one other than Jesus, the best one on that topic is Nietzsche, of all people. He has some wonderful things to say about that. The contrast between the individual and the herd, and how important it is not to just be absorbed into the herd. So okay.
Question. He's wondering if there's a difference between Socrates' daemon and a muse.
And what?
A muse.
I don't know. Yeah, good question, but I don't know the answer. Okay, we'll look at Socrates' project next week. And I hope you'll come to appreciate him like I do. I think he was an amazing man. So.